Session number 27053.
Mr. Dre, Reel 6. I think the next thing to do is to look at some of the weapons training you did besides the rifle. And of course, the first that comes to mind is the bayonet. Now, what type of bayonet training did you get?
Well, we had normally bayonet drill, like in, out, on guard, as I would just say. There was a football ground and a bit of a field up the back of the barracks, Britannia Barracks. The prison was overlooking us. The huge Norwich prison was there. And we were up there, and they used to hang sacks between tripods of logs and posts and things. And we had, of course, the small, we called it pig sticker bayonet on our Mark IV number one rifles, on number one Mark IV. And we would have to go up there, and we were told to put effort in it. We had to sort of yell a bit and thrust in, out, on guard, and this sort of caper. But it was more of a game than real serious bayonet fighting, because none of us ever imagined we'd have to use a bayonet. And incidentally, I've never used a bayonet. We fix bayonet when we go into battle, of course, say, make you fix your bayonet. But I've never had to stick a man with a bayonet or anywhere near. But we had this rushing up, stabbing the sandbag, hanging it was on a rope full of straw chaff or something. And then we'd pull it out and then run on the next one. And sometimes they would stand, there would be scaffolded, and an NCO would stand there. And as you were charging on, they'd push the sack across the front of you. So it was like a body leaping out at you, so you had to endeavour to stab that. But apart from that, that was the only bayonet, the bayonet in drill we done.
They're still doing a lot of encouraging you to scream and shout in the charge.
Yeah. Make yourself fearsome and, you know, aggressive attitude. Yeah. Put fear of Christ into Jerry, as they told us, like you see.
And what about the technicalities? I mean, it's that horrible, but you know about twisting, things like that.
Well, our little pig stickers would have come out. You didn't have to twist or anything. It would have, it stuck straight in, because it was it was about 10 inches long, 10 inches, I think. And it was round, about 3/8 diameter steel. Some of them had a bit of a flute on the side. There was two or three versions, Mark 1, 2 or so, but they had a flute on the side, which was for stopping suction, if you like, from the flesh, or the human body would hold it. So, but mainly ours weren't the great big 18-inch bayonets they'd used in previous war.
Other weapons, how about various types of hand grenades?
Yes, we had several hand grenades. One was a 69, a Bakelite thing. This thing had a pin, and it had a light, had a tape around it with a little piece of lead at the end. And this was wrapped around the cap. And when you took the cap off, you threw it into the air, and the lead weight then pulled the tape and pulled the pin out as it was travelling through the air. They were mainly practice grenades. And then there was this big bang, but you didn't have to be too near them, because you got shrapnel, Bakelite shrapnel, coming out of them. So they could be used for action if you wanted to, but then we mainly trained with them to give us experience of throwing a grenade. Well, then we went into the bombing bays, as they called it. There was dugouts where all the men were put in, and the NCO would call you out one at a time. You were given three grenades. We had, I think it was 7-second fuses on them then, and you stand in a stance with the left foot forward. You take the grenade in the right hand, and you put your left index finger in the ring, and you pull the grenade from the ring. So your right hand pulls the grenade back, and the ring and the pin is left in your index finger on your left hand. And that went shot behind you. Then you threw it over your head. We had oil drums about 20 yards out in front of us. We pulled it out, and then he would say, throw, and as you threw it as close to the oil drum as you could, you counted three. You watched where the thing, you didn't duck immediately for fear. You watched the grenade land, you heard it, the detonator go. You knew then you had 7 seconds before that thing exploded. So you watched it land, and then you just didn't panic. You just quietly ducked down underneath, and you'd hear that this dull thump, gone. So that's what the idea is, pulling the grenade and keeping the pin and wringing your hands. If you,
why was that done?
Well, if you were in action, and you found yourself there was no one to throw the grenade at, you could put the pin back into the thing, and you could then release the lever because it was quite safe. But when that pin was out, and once you let go of the grenade, the lever went up, struck this like 2-2 cap, and there was a little, you fuse these incidentally. I jumped ahead before we actually got into the bombing bay. The grenades were brought up, and they're never live, they're not armed. They had boxes of these fuses. They were little bits of little bit of tape it looked like, but it was a tube, but inside was a slow burning gunpowder or something. And when the pin went down, it strikes a 2-2. You push it in the bottom of the bay. There's a little cap. You have a special key. You undo it. Push this thing up, and the little 2-2 cap. And it's hard for me to describe it to people if you don't understand what they are. And then you put the cap back in, and you just tightened it with this key. It was just two little holes in the base cap, and you just screwed it tight. Then that was armed. That grenade was armed then. And once the pin was pulled out and the lever would on a hard spring would jump up, and down would go the firing pin, and away would go the grenade. So that's what we had to do first, was arming and disarming grenades before we went into the bombing bay.
Was there a special method of throwing them? I mean, or was it, I mean, because a lot of people seem to have described a cricketing action.
That's right. This was overhand. Yes, like a cricketer. You'd stand, and you'd pull the grenade, you'd watch the target facing it, sideways, pull the grenade out, and then they'd tell you to throw, and you over there and like that as far as you could.
How far could you throw it? 20 yards, 60
20
feet?
Yards, 20 yards. If you can throw 120 yards, you're doing, what is a grenade, a pound and a half, something like this. Memory doesn't keep that well with me, but it's over a pound, I think. And so you had, it was not uncommon when boys went into the, you're only in like a trench, just like a First World War trench, not a slit trench, a First War trench coming out the dugout. And it's quite common. I think you'd be, if anyone had been a bombing instructor would tell you, for lads to drop the grenade into the trench. And I was in a trench once with another lad, being an instructor, and his hand hit the back of the trench, and he released the grenade, and down it went. And this sergeant that was with us, almost like men were in them of, or mannering of Dad's army, he said, "Stupid boy," and he picked the grenade up quite calm, cool and collected, and threw it over the top and said, "Get down." It said, it was, that's why you had the longer fuse in action. You could have 7 second fuses then, but normally there were 3 seconds. Well, it wouldn't like to drop one at your feet and with a 3 second fuse, because you would have to be very smart to get it out clear of the trench. But that was quite a common occurrence for sergeants when they were instructing the bombing. They were quite brave chaps, really. But that's why they kept everyone else in dugouts out the way, because if someone did drop one and we couldn't get it out, it might blast a whole group of you, see. So they kept them in dugouts, even in the safety of the bombing bay up in Norwich there.
Any other grenades?
Yes. Well, the other thing that we were taught was a 77 grenade. 77, 75. I'm not absolutely sure. 70. This thing was an anti-vehicle mine as well, as it was a grenade. It's like a little tin box, and it had a pressure plate on the top of it. These, we were taught, they weren't a grenade as such. No, they were a little. This was a little mine, but we carried them with us, and we could lay them for Andy. They'd blow a wheel off of a car or something like that. A 77, but we called them grenades. And they were in a green tin, and they had a pressure plate. You could actually, a human body could tread on one and get away with it. But if we wanted to put if a tank's around or something, we could form a little minefield in an infantry platoon could, when they're up at the front. They've got these 77 grenades. Mm. The other one we had, of course, we used, was the smoke grenade thing, a phosphorus thing that they had. And these devils, they had a tape on them that pulled the pin, and these, they had a lot of smoke would come from them. And if you carried these with us, not everyone, but so many to a platoon. Later, this is when I was serving, but we were trained with them to throw these, and they would put up a cloud of smoke and give you a certain cover from observation with them. So we carried this. Now, I don't remember the number of the grenade that we used for smoke. That wasn't a grenade exactly that I've been trained with, what we called a toffee apple. This was a ball about as big as a coconut with a stick handle, and it had a tin case on it which you took off. You walked up to the vehicle and you smacked it on the side, and the glass broke and it was like all treacle and it stuck there, and then you could walk away quite steadily and the explosion would blow a hole in the tank, is the theory. And we were trained in 1943 with these. I never saw them in Italy. Later, I never saw them again. And why you could do that is explosives. Some will take the least line of resistance and others will take the greatest line of resistance. And this explosion went inwards, went up again. You stuck it against the wall of a tank or so forth. And when it exploded, the explosion went in. It didn't throw anything back at... So you didn't have to run. They would tell you to... And I've used them two or three times. Stick on it and just walk away from it. But mind you, obviously that nature made you be pretty smart getting away from it. So these were the things they trained us with.
Other words, were you introduced to any of the submachine guns, the Thompson and the Sten?
Yeah. When you say about Stens, we didn't have Stens, and never in Italy did I have a Sten. They had them out there. I'm not saying no people did, but we had all Tommy guns, Thompson submachine guns.
Tell me about them.
Well, they weren't the Chicago gangster style. They didn't have a drum magazine. We had 11 rounds, and we carried about... not every man had them. There were certain Tommy guns. As a matter of fact, the final action I ever fought, I was carrying a Tommy gun on these, which I will come to later tell you that I was carrying a Tommy gun that day. We had this. Now, what mark it was, I don't know. But the original ones had a big nozzle on them with slots on the top. This was what they call a gas eliminator. So when you fired the bullet with a Tommy gun, normally, if there was this wasn't on it, it tended to go up into the air, push you back, and the nozzle lift. So to avoid that, they cut slits in this. It was like a silencer on the end of the Tommy gun. But the gas is then so much shot out, and it had like a jet effect. It kept the barrel down. But the types that we had in Italy in action, we'd use them in training, but all we had was a tiny leaf sight up the front. And we had to learn to hold the damn thing and not let it go up. But we'd done quite a lot of Tommy gun training later.
How accurate? Because the Sten was very inaccurate. How accurate was the Thompson? What effective range?
Look, a Tommy gun, you're shooting at 30 yards. I mean, it's a 4-5... bullet you're using, and it's only a snubby sort of bullet. And no, you're not talking about long ranges with them, but in street fighting or in trenching, they were good because they'd spray around. You could spray them so easily. And that we'd walk through a woods, and there is again, they'd take us through usually a quarry or somewhere there was vegetation, and men would lay in slit trenches, and they would release figures, a fool like a dummy would come swinging out the tree, and you had to give it a burst, and or something would be pulled across your path, and you had to give it a burst, and it was quite easy to hit it, because these things sprayed so well. But I say you only had a magazine of 11, a long straight magazine you pushed underneath. But yes, they were very good.
Were they reliable? I mean, mechanically reliable.
Oh yes. No, they didn't jam very much. No. They were a good weapon. I liked them. I liked the Thompson submachine gun. I liked it. It was my sort of toy, and I think I'd probably volunteered to carry one when I was finally, as I'm telling you, using one.
Now, what about the light machine gun?
Yeah, this is the Bren.
Lewis or the Bren?
No, we had the Bren. And we did have the Bren, and we fired them on a 30 yards range to start with. You know, it's a very accurate machine gun, and you can waste ammunition if you went there. As you hear stories of the Great War, they were purring like a cat, you know, with the Vickers machine guns, and belts were being used at multiple seconds, rounds per second. But we used to fire in short bursts, five rounds is what. The way we were taught was, Johnny, get your gun. Johnny, get your gun. If you could get that in your head as you pulled it, you could feel the thing, and you knew you were firing about five when you as you could say them words, Johnny, get your gun. And they were very accurate. You could, on a 30 yards range, an ordinary average chappie, once he's trained and that, he would be able to hit what, in a 2-inch diameter, he'd put the five rounds in there. But and they are good machine gun, without a doubt. The Bren was very handy.
What about stripping and maintenance?
Yeah. Well, what they do, they lay beside you, and in a barrack room, sometimes on a wet day, this is how they trained you. I had the machine gun set there, and they'd say, there was, I can't remember it word for word, the training went something like, gun fires, gun stops. And so then what do you do? They then tell you the first thing you do, like a motor car, if it stops, you check if there's petrol. So you check if there's ammunition. If the magazine's run out, it's obvious that's why it would stop. So you're carrying spare magazines in an infantry platoon. A lot of men have to carry Bren gun magazines, and they've not got a Bren gun. It's to feed the platoon. Generally, the two or three machine guns that you got with you. So you check that. So you hit the little lever behind and open the magazine and check. If there is, then, and it might say gun fires, gun stops again. Well, then there's a little, they're fired by gas. So there's a little body that, and you've got a key with them. Mind you, if you're in action, all this sort of thing, this is in the barrack room training. You turn and give them a bit more gas. You can open up the aperture, the gas aperture, which it thrusts the firing lever forward. So there was this sort of thing. And the worst come to the worst, you carry a spare barrels with Bren guns. You've actually got spare barrels, and you can change the barrels. Sometimes they get very hot. And then when they get hot, mine, then, you know, you have to. So there are spare barrels being carried by infantry platoons. So, that yes, they call it firing task or something like this, what we're trained over. How to, what to do if the machine gun stops, and how to...
What about general stripping it down? I mean, they used to do it blindfold, some units.
I could do that because there was nothing to it. When you're talking about Vickers machine guns, that's a different story altogether. There's what they call the block in there, and I think it was 13 pieces had to be put in, and one thing another, just in the firing block of a Vickers. But on the Bren gun, there was no difficulty at all. It was easy, very easy. There was a carrying handle. You lifted it, took it, pushed the lever up, and your barrel came off. It was very easy. And this gas regulator, little key, it was quite easy. There was no Well, a simpleton would, after a few lessons, knew how to strip and assemble a Bren gun.
Now, you wouldn't go up to the Vickers, would you?
At that time,
in basic training, or did you?
No.
What about mortars, the two-inch or the three-inch?
Yeah, we're coming to the only mortar that an ordinary soldier in a rifle company uses is a two-inch. And the two-inch mortar, yes, we fired that. We fired smoke. We fired HE. And we fired, and there was a parachute flare, not a very light, it was a flare. We had some of our bombs we could fire and put a very light, not a very light, a flare come to give us observation. But mainly HE, of course. These bombs, of course, are marked. I would be a memory man if I knew everything, but they used to have red and green crosses marked on them on a black band, which indicate they were high explosive, and they had various colouring markings on them to indicate what they were.
And what was it like to fire? How did it actually work?
It had a base plate and just a two-inch tube stuck up with a round knob, which you turned to get elevation and so forth. And there was a sighting, just a small sighting mechanism. And you placed the blade, and you laid behind it like a machine gun, like you would the Bren. There would be two of you, and one would put the grenade in, and all you'd done, you had this round knob that, there was another knob beside the elevator, and you just turned that, and you'd hear it go punk. And that was the spring firing with the firing, because on the bomb, in the centre of the fins at the base, there was a thing very much like a 12-bore shotgun cartridge, a ballistite cartridge as they call it, and it was almost identical to a shotgun system. When you turn this lever and it clicked, you were pushing down a spring, and then you went past it, and the spring allowed the firing pin to go up, and it struck it just like a 12-bore shotgun firing pin, which then fired this thing, this cartridge, which had this, and that was what propelled the bomb into the air. The ballistite cartridge, the explosion in that, threw it up into the air.
So you didn't just drop them in, you dropped them in and then turned the...
Yeah, so you never dropped them in the tube, but you had to fire them with this cartridge. And it's exactly the same with you're talking about the 3-inch when you drop them in, exactly the same thing happens. Down it goes, but the firing pin is waiting there, and it falls on its... So it drops down the barrel.
So that's the one you drop in and fire automatically.
Well, now, I've never fired one, I've never been trained, because in the infantry in them days, we're coming to the end of my primary training now. I've done all this in 6 weeks of primary training that I've told you up to now. I can't think of any other weapon at all.
Now, any other training you remember? I mean, was there an assault course?
Yes, there was assault courses where we had to jump across ditches, where we had to swing across a ditch full of barbed wire and all sorts of horrible junk on a rope, and if you let go, they just told you was an idiot when you fell among the barbed wire and had to get yourself out. Yes, we did. We had assault courses, walls, bunking one another over the walls. The first two to the wall would crouch down, and the others would leap up, and it didn't matter about having nail boots on, they stood on your back and over they went, and then they'd drag you over. All this sort of thing went on. Same as today, the assault course is identical. It was a cross between army training and physical training sort of thing. Yes, we did.
What about gas mask training?
Yes, you remind me. We had gas training. The first one, we went into this gas room, a sort of a building where the specialist NCOs, you see, in a barracks when they're training young recruits, there's what they call the permanent staff, and these are experts on their individual things like machine guns, grenades, so forth. So there was gas instructors, and that was their permanent job, usually corporal, sergeant. Well, the first thing we done, to put on our arm with a brush, mustard gas. They put it on our arm, and they told us that if we thought we were clever and that wasn't Gus's gas, just leave it, because there would be a damn great blister there in a few, in an hour's time. So they then say, you've had mustard gas on your arm, now you're going in the next thing, and we're going to give you the treatment to decontaminate yourself. And they gave us some cotton wool swabs and some unction lotion, I don't know what it was, and we had to clean the mustard gas away from off our arm. And if you'd done that, there was no ill effect at all, but it was mustard gas they put on our arm. They then took us through two forms of gas. Now, I think one was chloride gas that they'd used in the First World War, and the other one, offhand, I can't think what it was, but this was in a sealed gas chamber, and then they come in there, and you put your gas mask on and go in, and they're in there talking to you, are you all right, and one thing another, and then they say, right, pull your finger in the side of the cheek of the same and pull it away from your cheek, and you put it, and they let you have just a small whiff of the gas to let you know you were in a gas chamber. So all of you took a whiff of two types of gas we were trained in at different times. So yes, we had been trained with gas, and that was the three, as I remember, the mustard and two other inhaling gases that we were tested with, yeah.
Now, we were sort of looking at a typical day at one point. I mean, we're just sort of going through. In the evening, would there be much of an emphasis on getting ready for kit inspections? I mean, was that part of it? Or, I mean, was there a lot of bull?
Not a lot, really, no. Not what some might think it was. You had to make your bed up. You had an iron bedstead, and you had not. You didn't have a long mattress. You had what they call biscuits. I think it was two or three. I'm not absolutely sure. Probably they were two. If they were 3 foot square, they probably had two. And you had no sheets, of course, no pajamas. You had blankets, army blankets, wool blankets. And I think we had three. So in the mornings when you got up, you had to lay the two biscuit biscuits on what we called a mattress, you'd call normally, yes, these biscuit mattresses, and put them on one on top of the other. Then you had a pillow thing. And then you had to fold your blankets in such a way as they wrapped around. Now, on the blankets, you had a little yellow material label with your name on it. And they had to face out so that anyone stood at the foot of the bed could see your name on the blankets. You then depend in it, because during training, you wear a sort of thing. We called them dungarees sort of thing. Not your battle dress and that sort of thing, and they had to be your, and if you wasn't using your helmet and equipment, they had to be drooped over the blankets with your helmet on top, spare boots polished and facing out, housewife, that's your sewing kit and that, and your boot equipment's on the other side. These had to be tidy, but apart from that,
so you didn't, how obsessive were they about, say, polishing your boots? Because you know in some units they're really strict.
They were, but the boots we used every day, we dubbing them. We had dubbing, but the best boots, then they had to be shone, but you're not going out in mud and that, so they didn't take a lot of, once you'd got them burnished nicely and shiny, they were easy to maintain that. They was easy to keep.
And what were the kit inspections like? I mean, how?
Well, then, these would be inspected while we were out training, doing whatever our ordinary barrack room would be. And if the duty officer and sergeant found anything wrong, then of course in each barrack room there was a little sort of cubicle up the end where the corporal in charge of the barrack, he lived. Well, it would be him that catches it in the ear when he got back, and then in turn he would pass that aggravation onto the lads, and so that might mean that night you would be bumping the floor, polishing the floor of this damn great barrel room, and doing all sorts of things to as a bit of a. But usually the men were fairly good. The corporal would come round and see you before you go out. That's not.